Welcome. My name is Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, our board of directors, to this program that actually gives you a chance to ask the experts, as we say, about the current state of health reform. Here, let me get a little closer to this microphone. Our partner in the program today is the Eli Lilly Company and its affiliated foundation. Lilly's the 10th largest pharmaceutical company in the world, consistently ranked in the polls as one of the best companies in the world to work for. If you want to verify that, you can talk to Kathy Miller and Sean Donahue from Lilly, who are here. We want to thank them for their support for this program. August and early September have been a lot more action-packed than usual around this town, largely because of the debate over health care reform. There's been a lot of shouting around the country, even a little shouting right here in D.C., and now it's time to see if folks can maybe lower their voices a bit and hold a civil, productive conversation over how to fix what's broken in our health care system. And the purpose of today's program is to clear away some of the rhetorical underbrush and take a clear look at where we are, what direction we seem to be moving, and whether that direction seems to be a good thing. Quick logistical note, you have materials in your packets, including biographical sketches of our speakers. The materials in your kits are also available on the Alliance website at allhealth.org. There'll be a webcast of the briefing available sometime tomorrow, courtesy of the Kaiser Family Foundation, through both our website and the KFF.org Foundation's website, and we'll have a transcript available within a week or so. And we have a slightly different arrangement from our usual one. You can see we have more than our usual complement of panelists. Judy Fader has thus far come dressed as an empty seat, but she's on her way. And we actually have assembled, I think, a spectacular collection of insight and intelligence on this issue. We're going to get an initial brief orientation on where we are by Julie Rovner. Then we're going to open the program up to questions from you immediately. We have some already received. We have microphones both in the front and in the back of the room. And you have green question cards in your packets that you can write a question on and hold it up. We request that you keep your questions as brief as you possibly can. Panelists, in turn, have agreed to keep their answers as brief as they can without distorting their response. And the purpose is to get to as many of your questions as possible in the 100 or so minutes that we have. So let me simply list and identify our panelists rather than give them their properly deserved introductions and refer you to the biographical information in your packets for more. Bob Berenson at the far end of the table in this direction at the Urban Institute. Next to him is Dennis Smith, who's now at the Heritage Foundation. On my immediate right is Julie Rovner from National Public Radio. Next, we have the inimitable Joseph Antost from the American Enterprise Institute, and next to him, Henry Aaron from the Brookings Institution.
That was too much of an introduction for me, Ed.
We're going to see, Henry, whether you're as admirable as Joe or as estimable as Dennis in the course of the 100 minutes here. We've asked Julie Rovner from NPR to kick off our discussion by grounding us in sort of the basics of what the debate's all about as a jumping-off point for your questions. And I will introduce Julie.
Okay. Can everybody hear me? This is a good start. It seems to be on. Having looked over the list of participants, I find it more than a bit presumptuous for me to be telling this audience anything about the current debate, since I know some of you actually have had a hand in writing some of the bills under consideration. But these are my instructions. I intend to follow them, and I'm sure you won't hesitate to yell, "You lie," if I make a mistake. I will only ask in that situation that you apologize, since I will not make any misstatements with malice aforethought or to gain any political advantage, since I do not intend to run for any political office now or in the future. I think I will begin with what seems to be the most misunderstood part of this entire debate. President Obama does not have a bill. In fact, until last week, he didn't even really have a plan. What he had was basically a page of guidelines laid out in the budget document issued way back last winter. So all summer, whenever anyone complained that the president's plan would or wouldn't do this or that, and I include members of the media, they were basically demonstrating they didn't really have a clue what they were talking about. Now, that did change somewhat with the president's speech Wednesday night, sort of. Here's pretty much what we now know about what Mr. Obama wants. He will veto a bill that adds to the deficit, except we're pretty sure that the $245 billion for the dock fee fix doesn't count. He's thinking that the package will cost around $900 billion over the next 10 years. He wants to lower health care costs in the long run, or bend the cost curve, to use Budget Director Orszag's favorite phrase, and he'll support a trigger to require further spending cuts if anticipated cuts don't happen as projected. That's what we call the soft trigger. He really, really wants to ensure there's competition for the private insurance industry, and he'd like there to be a public plan. But he believes Max Baucus when Max Baucus says there aren't the votes for that in the Senate, and he, the president, is willing to settle for co-ops or a trigger or something that someone hasn't thought of yet, but he dearly hopes someone will pretty soon. He wants, back to the president, an individual mandate, and this is a major change for where candidate Obama was, if you remember back to the primaries with Hillary Clinton, and he would like to require big businesses to either cover their workers or pay a fee. Most small businesses would be exempt. He wants an exchange for individuals and small businesses to be able to buy coverage and subsidies and tax credits to help those who couldn't otherwise afford it. He wants a whole series of insurance market reforms, no limits on pre-existing conditions, no rescissions after people buy coverage, no more lifetime or annual caps, and catastrophic out-of-pocket limits on all policies. So basically an end to the problem of underinsurance. Now, how these proposals are going to get into the existing legislation is a really interesting question I will leave for my esteemed, inimitable, whatever you would like to call them, colleagues. Meanwhile, we actually do have several bills in various stages of legislative process. You have a side-by-side in your packet, so I won't go into a lot of detail, but here's a very quick review for those of you who've been napping for the past few months. H.R. 3200 is currently not one but three different bills, the versions as marked up by the Ways and Means, Education and Labor, and Energy and Commerce Committees. I should caution you in particular that the Energy and Commerce Committee made major changes, first in order to satisfy enough of those fiscal conservative blue dog Democrats to vote for the bill, and then in order to re-satisfy some of the more progressive members of the committee, because by the time they got those blue dog votes, they had lost some of the progressive votes and didn't have enough votes to get it through the committee, so they had to go back and change it again. Basically, the bill's outlines are pretty much as President Obama described. Remember that last line when he said details are to be worked out. There's an exchange, an individual and a business mandate, insurance reforms, reductions in Medicare and Medicaid spending. Oh, and H.R. 3200 has this tax on people with high incomes to help finance it. If I might add, the exercise the House Democratic leadership now faces is pretty much the exercise that the Energy and Commerce Committee had to go through. They have to basically come up with a bill that can get 218 votes by walking that tightrope between progressives and conservatives in their caucus. And this isn't just about the public plan, even though that's what everybody's been yelling about. It's about things like the size of tax credits and subsidies and closing the donut hole in Medicare's prescription drug benefit and how big the deficit or non-deficit, what we're going to have to pay for, is going to be. Over to the Senate side, all the focus has been on the Finance Committee, but we actually have a bill reported out of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. We still haven't seen bill text, at least I haven't the last time I looked, nor a full CBO estimate, but we were treated to weeks and weeks and weeks of markup for those of us who had nothing better to do with our June and July. The general outlines of the help bill look a lot like H.R. 3200, although it calls its exchanges gateways instead. It has relatively more generous subsidies. It doesn't have any financing mechanisms because that, after all, is up to the Finance Committee in the Senate. which brings us finally to the Finance Committee. That's where we have the notorious Gang of Six, Chairman Max Baucus, Ranking Republican Chuck Grassley, along with Democrats Kent Conrad and Jeff Bingaman, and Republicans Mike Enzi and Olympia Snowe, working behind closed doors for the past 4 months or so in an effort to get a package that can pass the committee and the Senate. And I got to tell you, I'm really, really, really tired of sitting outside Max Baucus's door. Senator Baucus, as I'm sure you all know, said last week he's going ahead with his own mark later this week and a committee markup next week. Somehow that got transfigured. I heard a news report last week that it's going to the Senate floor this week. I'm not sure how that a mark became going to the Senate floor, but welcome to the wonderful echo chamber of Washington. But the proposal he put before the group of six leaked last week, and by the magic of Xerox machines, you have that in your package too. That mark is generally less expensive and less generous, but a little bit more controlling of cost, at least so we're told, than the House or the HELP bills. Its financing also relies more on dunning providers who aren't particularly happy about it. They have been clogging my email box the last week telling me that. So what happens next? Well, it's up to the House leadership to merge 3,200 from its current three-bill iteration back into one bill for a floor vote that can get 218 votes. Not totally clear exactly when that will happen, and we will wait to see what emerges first from the group of six and then from the Finance Committee. I'll leave it back to Ed.
Well, that was simple. Anybody care to do the conference committee and the bill signing ceremony for us, and we can end a little early. I'm absolutely serious. We are depending. Not only we encourage you, but we find it essential that you participate in this process with questions. Let me just carry out, while you're either walking up to the microphones or filling out your green cards, for anybody who would like to give us a little Civics 101 lecture, how do we get from three bills to one bill? You made a reference, Julie, to the House leadership. How do you get from HELP and finance, assuming that the Finance Committee can get its act together and get a bill through, to a single bill on the floor? I know enough from my 30 years ago days on the Hill what happens once they get the conference, at least in the How Our Laws Are Made diagram. But how do you get to a single bill on the floor in the House and the Senate, respectively? Mechanics? Anybody? Anybody from CRS who would like to describe that? Dennis, did you have to deal with this when you were running Medicaid?
We did, and when I worked on Senate Finance previously, and basically the way you get there is after, in the Senate, you'll have the two different committee bills, and there will be a big manager's amendment presented on the floor, and suddenly that's what everybody will be in, and at this point we don't know what that is. In the House, the same way, it'll be written, there will be a rule written in the Rules Committee, and that amendment will be in order and probably virtually nothing else, and that's what will go to the House floor.
Yeah, my understanding is that there's a big difference between this and in budget reconciliation when you're doing a bill and you have energy and commerce and ways and means doing Medicare, for instance, and you get things that conflict, which often happens. Those things go to the floor conflicting, and it gets worked out in conference. In a situation like this, I think they resolve them beforehand, so they will not go. If you're going to do regular order, they will not go to the floor conflicting. They will be worked out, and that's a big difference if they end up having to go the reconciliation route, that reconciliation, indeed, you will have different versions, because those are put together by the Budget Committee, and because of the way reconciliation works, you actually end up passing things that are in conflict, and they get worked out later. That will not be the case this time. I think there will be one bill, and it will be up to, you know, the leadership to determine what it thinks can get 218 votes, and there will be one bill. It will be worked out, as Dennis says, at the Rules Committee.
Okay. We have folks at the microphones. Let me just reiterate, please identify yourself. Please keep your question short, and go ahead.
Okay. Tony Hausner. First, I just want to encourage people to sign up for Organizing for America, to help push at the grassroots level reform. I'd like to ask each of the panel members to comment on what they think the chances are of a reform bill that will pass and that the bill would cover a reasonable percentage of the uninsured.
I was busy kicking over my water glass, so I didn't hear Tony's question. I hope somebody on the panel did and can respond. We now are joined by Judy Fader from Georgetown. And
Ed, my question was to each of the panel members, what do they think the chances of reform passing and covering a reasonable percentage of the uninsured?
That's fairly straightforward.
Tony, I'd say pretty damn good. And it's essentially, and I apologize for it not having been here earlier. I was at another similar conversation. You all know that we've never gotten quite so far. That may not be, that's not getting all the way there. But I think that the short story on why it is that we're going to take action is that and this is simply too big to fail. There is too much riding on it in terms of both the expectations of the American people and of the President and members of Congress in terms of delivering for people. I think that I won't go into whether the times are different, but I think that that a delivery, a significant impact bill, is expected.
Since Tony asked for responses from others, anyone who feels moved to make a prediction should feel free to do that.
I was going to say that I agree with Judy, but I would refer back to President Bill Clinton, who said, and I'm paraphrasing, it all depends on what the meaning of the word it is. I think it's quite likely that a bill will be passed and signed by the President, and whatever its character, I think the President, and with some justification, will be able to claim that this was a great year for health reform. That said, it's by no means obvious to me that the bill is going to be as large as any of those currently that have currently emerged from committee, either the HELP bill or the H.R. 3200. Senate Finance, we've seen general descriptions of, but not detailed cost estimates. In your package, you have an article that was in the New England Journal that I wrote on financing, and I think there are some key numbers to keep in mind here. The hard nut here is that you're going to end up spending about 20% of the 10-year cost in the 10th year alone, and if, as the President has pledged, and I do believe he means what he is saying, the bill has to be balanced in the 10th year. That means a trillion-dollar bill costs $200 billion in the 10th year. The HELP bill is a little larger than that and costs still more. The Baucus bill will probably be smaller and cost a bit less. But that's still a great deal of money. Finding a combination of spending cuts and tax increases to cover that, I think, is the really tough nut to crack. Public option is going to go away. It's been grossly exaggerated in importance, in my view, by both proponents and opponents, and it seems to be receding. But paying for the bill can't go away. That's here, and finding the money is, I think, in the end, going to be a constraint on how much Congress will find it itself able to do.
Dennis? Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, thank you. Let me just add to Henry's comments. I completely agree. And just to say that the government's favorite way of financing anything in health care is, of course, to take Medicare cuts. This will be particularly challenging this year. Not that the cuts are that people are talking about are all that unusual, at least at the talking stage. But thanks to all the hype, senior citizens we've awakened the sleeping beast, so to speak. And I don't really mean
I
to
think
say
I resemble that remark.
I don't really mean to say that about my mother.
The sleeping geezer,
exactly. But they are awake, and so it'll be more difficult than ever before to take the kinds of reductions in provider payments in Medicare that we've actually grown to expect.
Yes, go ahead, Vincent.
We're going on down the line here. I agree something will pass. Whether that something is really reform is a different question. I think that there are so many difficult inconsistencies and competing values that are presented that it's going to be very hard to reconcile them. I would, I think the financing, the Medicare cuts, there are, again, I think still what the economy is doing within the next couple of months are going to be very important. I think that there is a big push to show that there is huge momentum. I think that momentum is not as folks would like us to believe. And I think members of Congress at the end of the day will act like members of Congress, which is what is in their own best self-interest.
Well, I'll make a different kind of a point. I think it's likely that the way you posed your question, which had to do with coverage expansion mostly and maybe insurance reform, I think it's likely we'll pass a bill. I'm with Judy on that one. There has been a view that, and in fact some language, that this is health insurance reform, not health reform. That has, and David Brooks and others have sort of commented about the lack of systematic health reform that is emerging, and I am partly persuaded that that's right, but it's a sort of a glass half full or half empty thing. There's a lot of good stuff in the House on demonstrations and pilots to test lots of delivery system reform ideas. So on the one hand, you can say it will be disappointing for those of us who think we need major overhaul of how care is delivered. On the other hand, I don't think if you actually that we're actually we're ready to put all of these new payment systems in place tomorrow. It would have made the politics much more complicated. So I think it's likely that we will have a health insurance coverage expansion bill. It will not be any broader than what's being talked about now, and will probably be cut back even more. But it will get us on the road, and I actually think there's some promising things down the road in if what emerges include some of the elements that I've seen in the House language.
Thank you all. Let me just remind you that you don't need to ask every panelist to respond to every question. We want to be able to cover as much ground as we can, and I sense a certain level of disagreement among the members of the panel. So we may be hearing from multiple people in any event. But go ahead.
Hi, I'm Stephen Spitz, and my question relates to Medicare Advantage. Just before President Obama was inaugurated this week with George Stephanopoulos, he was asked what programs would he eliminate in health, and he said that Medicare Advantage, because the government shouldn't be in the business of subsidizing private insurance companies. Whoever cares to answer this question, what do you think is going to happen to Medicare Advantage in the legislation that will be passed?
I have a view. Go. Joe, go ahead. And then Bob.
Medicare Advantage is plagued by a variety of problems, one of which is a bidding system that guarantees payments, according to MedPAC, upwards of 14% higher than the equivalent cost of Medicare services in the fee-for-service program. So obviously, it is an interesting budget target. However, the big challenge with that target is that, especially in the Senate, there are health plans now in rural parts of the country that never would have existed without the, let's call them overpayments. And what they actually buy for people out there, and not just in rural areas, but also in urban areas, what that buys for people are some extra benefits. In essence, it's a kind of government-paid wraparound plan for people who didn't necessarily have access to such a thing paid for by an employer. So bottom line is that there are a lot of senators from mostly western and rural parts of the country who have really stood up for Medicare Advantage, and I think what that means inevitably is that there will be some policy that will pare back the payments, but I don't think it's going to go all the way to the policy in the President's budget, which would essentially level them out with fee-for-service over the course of 3 years.
Could I just add, by way of extending what I said previously, a budget document presented in February claimed $177 billion over 10 years in savings from leveling down Medicare Advantage payments. That's included in the something north of $900 billion of tax increases and spending cuts that the administration has put forward, first as a reserve in the budget for health reform and subsequently through additional proposed cuts in Medicare and Medicaid. Subtract 177 from 900, you're down to a little over 700. I think that drives home the tension between the scope of the plan and the methods of finance.
Let me just jump in also. I agree with Joe's analysis of the difficulty in Senate finance of just taking the 14% away. I think the President actually has missed the point that it will not be painless to reduce overpayments to plans. I was at HCFA at the time that the BBA passed and was there. I mean, within a month of my arrival, I got the first call about what is this we're hearing about plans pulling out. And the next 3 years that I was there was, I guess, the number one item on my agenda was trying to manage some of the dislocation that took place. I think as policy, the overpayments are unjustified and need to be cut back. It happens that the House and the Senate have two different approaches so far. It looks like the House would just phase out over 3 years the overpayments and get to payment neutrality, the original MedPAC notion of payment neutrality, which is at the local area level, paying the plans the same risk-adjusted amount that is in the traditional Medicare program, essentially go back to the pre-BBA payment neutrality days, and they would do that over a couple years. They do have a pay-for-performance add-on to give some money back to some plans. The Senate, from what I've seen in the framework that has leaked that Julie talked about, is adopting, apparently, at least the Gang of Six, the President's proposal for competitive bidding amongst the plans. They would actually phase that in over about a four-year period, first taking a 3% away from the plans and then phasing in a combination of administered pricing and competitive bidding, and ultimately by 2014 having a competitive bidding, but only amongst the plans, not premium support notions that have been around, which would include traditional Medicare. So how this all plays out, I'm not sure. A dynamic that still exists is the fact that some of the Democratic senators from Washington and Oregon and some places where they have strong, very good plans are being protective, and at the same time, it's an obvious place where savings are to be found, and I would argue in programmatic grounds it's hard to justify these overpayments.
If I can just do a slight follow-up here, both Dennis and Joe referred to either mothers or moderators who might be nervous or cuts in Medicare. It's clear in the opinion polls that the support for reforms is less robust among people my age and over than it is in younger ages, and I wonder whether panelists might have an opinion about whether older people ought to be nervous about either the Medicare Advantage provisions or the overall impact on their health care of the proposals as they're floating around. Judy?
I think that the nervousness and the poll data that we're seeing reflects, in large part, a lot of the misinformation that, that I don't know whether we need to go into anymore. I'm prepared to let it die, shall we say. So a major effort to scare seniors. And when we actually look at the legislation, I think that they should not be nervous. There may not be as much in the bill as they would like, but I would say that, as Joe Anto said, when we look at the payment reductions that are in Medicare that are part of the financing, those are tiny with respect to the overall future costs of Medicare. They are significantly lower than reductions that have been made in the past. Hospitals, for example, have not had a reduction in their update. We used to see them on a regular basis, and a slowdown in their legislated increase. Haven't seen one in years. There's evidence that hospitals, the only hospitals for whom Medicare payments are not sufficient, are the hospitals who are not facing competitive pressure from in the private insurance market for the under 65 population. So we've got lots of evidence that these payments are adequate. And the reductions in payment that are being proposed are expected to extend the life of the trust fund. And the reality is that we know that we have a Medicare financing program into the future, and that changes of this kind are necessary for Medicare sustainability, and in the context of health reform, for providers will be offset by substantially more patients as we expand coverage. So in terms of the discussion we've been having, I don't think they should be nervous. I think we should also look to the payment reforms that are aimed at improving over time. It is a challenge, the availability of primary care, enabling more providers to spend more time with patients, the combination of the pharmaceutical industry pledge and other provisions to close the donut hole, and major improvements in preventive benefits and benefits for low-income people. So I think there's a lot to be that seniors should welcome in health reform and be afraid of a failure to begin to put the nation on a track that actually does create affordable health care for everybody, because that endangers Medicare along with everything else.
Dennis?
Yeah, I think, and having done a few town halls, seniors are nervous about a number of different things. Health care is one of them, but they're also nervous about the deficit. They're nervous about the implications for their grandchildren, et cetera. So you hear them express a lot of different concerns, not just about health care. And part of the problem, I think, is that they've been conditioned over the years from different provider groups and advocacy groups. In the past, whenever Congress of whatever party or of whatever administration touches Medicare, they are immediately blasted X number of alerts saying Congressman so-and-so wants to end your Medicare. So it's a little hard for them to shift gears now and say $500 billion isn't going to impact you. So, again, I think a lot of it is people are hearing so many inconsistent messages, and they are using their own common sense to say, look, something just isn't right here. And I think that's really what's making them nervous.
Bob, you want to add something?
Yeah, just very quickly. Part of what's going on in the Hill now is something like a food fight over geographic variations. That, and you know, this comes out of the Dartmouth data. There is some disagreement over the magnitude of the geographic variations emerging, but there's no disagreement amongst anything that I've seen that there is still significant geographic variations, with higher spending areas not producing higher value. Whether it's 15% or 30%, we're trying to bend the cost curve 1.5%. I think that there's plenty of opportunity, as Judy mentioned, to do that. Given the sort of both the providers and the beneficiaries' voice on the Hill, I don't think it'll be done precipitously. I think we can absorb these kinds of cuts over 10 years. And so there is nervousness. I agree with Dennis that that's out there. But I actually think we can have a reformed Medicare program, and that can contribute to help. I mean, it can become financially sustainable. It'll be difficult to get there.
Yes, go ahead.
Terry Gardner with Small Business Majority. My question is about the health insurance exchange, specifically the proposed by the Senate 50 state exchanges. And how do the panelists think this would work in our small states, the 20 states that are under 2 million in population, have already a lot of insurance concentration and provider concentration? Will a state-based exchange really change anything as proposed?
And while you're contemplating that policy aspect of it, let me just throw in a factual question that someone has asked on a card. Excuse me, which has a political component as well. Which of the cooperatives? I'm sorry.
Different
question. Never mind. So, I have given the panelists time to think about their answers.
You wouldn't have done that when you were younger. I say that as older than you. Let me take a crack at it. I think the idea of having exchanges in relatively small, thinly populated or lightly populated geographic units would not realize the full advantages that I think exchanges hold as a potential. My own view is that if one started with state units and included language authorizing collaboration across state lines between differing groups of states, that an essentially state-based system could be a sensible beginning. But the key would be to let Delaware or Wyoming or other small states join with neighboring states in order to achieve a little bit larger marketing unit.
You know, I would argue that the geography doesn't have too much to do with it. They don't have to be necessarily next to each other. I mean, that's something that people often imagine has to be the case. We're talking about a financial product, and if you have a computer, you have a market, essentially. I think the problem here is that we're starting from an institutional base that is kind of hard for people to get over, especially state insurance commissioners.
But what about provider networks?
That's an issue. There's a difference between insurance and the provision of services, and that was a point I was about to get to. It does make sense to try to promote more competition and choice in all geographic areas where that's possible. But in the end, when you think about where you're going to find savings, in the end, as we know, most of the money we spend in healthcare is for services. All the talk about administrative costs and insurance and so on, that's the small part of it. If you can't organize a provider network, if you can't encourage your provider network to be efficient, in other words, if you don't change anything about the delivery system, then this is a relatively small part of the answer.
Yes, go ahead.
Doug Trapp, American Medical News. One of the issues, and this is for anybody on the panel with an opinion, but what are the issues that the Democrats are not dealing with in their legislation that you think are going to have to be dealt with at some point in the health system?
Wow. That assumes that we know what's going to be in the legislation, I guess.
Well,
Dennis,
I'll start since everybody else is going to be shy. Well, I think one of the biggest is you're adding more to a Medicaid program. Medicaid's already in big trouble. The states are already pushing back. And to put another 11 to 15 million people into Medicaid, I think, is not realistic. A year ago, the GAO said Medicaid was unsustainable. You know, that's before any of this additional responsibilities were going to be piled onto it. So I think the Medicaid expansion is a huge issue that they don't seem to really be dealing with the reality of what is facing Medicaid.
Where'd you go, sir? Oh, there. Okay. That's, I would take issue with that, Dennis, because the issue of Medicaid capacity has a great deal to do with the resources that go in. And although there are issues about future state obligations, the legislative expansions of Medicaid are coming with substantial increases in federal resources. So I don't think that counts as something that isn't in the bill, because for God's sakes, it is in the bill, and there are lots of future issues to be dealt with. I'm hard put to see what I mean. I think that the view of legislation as it's going forward is that even if extremely successful, as I hope it will be, it's not putting any of us out of business. There will be plenty of work to be done in the future. So I think its scope, and I'm not one who's going to broaden its scope at the moment, but I think it's putting in place, whether it's coverage or, as we were talking about earlier, the mechanisms to slow cost growth, things that we will be continuing to work on and refine. And just if I were going to stretch and think about something that wasn't there, even it is there, and that is, and relates to Medicaid too, or provisions related to long-term supports and services, Medicaid being our primary financer. And it is, I think, quite interesting to note that in both the House, the Energy and Commerce legislation, along with the HELP bill, there is a proposal there is a provision establishing a class act, for creating a new insurance program for long-term supports and services. So even that's in there. So I'm not an advocate of expanded scope, although I think there's going to be plenty left to do.
If I may respond, though, again, what I was alluding to, maybe I didn't say it very well, in terms of Medicaid, simply saying, go get us more money for Medicaid is not really a solution. I mean, that's not really reform. It doesn't take a lot of imagination simply to expand Medicaid eligibility and say, well, let's just go get more money for it. That's what I meant was I don't think they're really dealing with the reality.
Henry, you didn't think there should be very much in it in the first place.
Oh, on the contrary, that's not the case. I was for going for absolutely as much as you could get. The question was how much you could get, and things are looking a little better, I think, than they did a while ago. I think there is a very important issue that has not been addressed. Conservatives and liberals alike look at the healthcare delivery system and bewail the fact that it is as fragmented as it is, that there's too little coordination in the delivery of care through most of the U.S. healthcare system. There are islands within that system that are exceptional, Mayo, Geisinger, and so on, the ones that President Obama mentioned. And we all agree, I think, that we would be better off if there were more such organizations delivering healthcare in the United States. But at this point, a lot of the discussion moves in the direction of the old economist joke. How do you open the can? You assume a can opener? Well, in this case, we assume, in effect, more such organizations. They're not going to spring up all by themselves. They're going to require entrepreneurs with financial incentives to pull them together, get doctors to participate, wrap hospitals in, and have the administrative know-how to run these coordinated systems. That is going to take a massive effort. I don't see it in the legislation. I'm not sure it can be in the legislation at this point, but in terms of what the nation needs in order to achieve the transformation that I think we all agree would be desirable, that, I think, is the single most important thing that we need to do.
Yes, go ahead, Bob.
Let me pick up on that. I agree with Henry that we need to transform delivery into those kinds of organizations, but that brings up an issue that is my number one issue that hasn't been really talked about, which is the development in many markets over the last 5 to 10 years of provider market power. Hospitals in particular, certain single specialty physicians who are able to ask for and get significant multiples of Medicare reimbursement rates from health plans because they are what's called must-have entities. There's a number of strategies that providers have engaged in, legal ones. I don't frankly think antitrust policy is going to touch most of what is going on. To me, it's actually a reason to have a public plan. I agree with Henry that I wouldn't die on my sword over the absence of a public plan, but a public plan which had some not just a weak one, but one that actually could set rates, would be viewed, I think, by providers as a moderating influence on their demands for rate increases from health plans. If we don't have a public plan, I think we're going to be somewhere in the next 5 years talking about rate regulation or some kind of regulation on private sector prices. I think it's an issue that's going to boil over one of these years. And to Henry's point, once we had the kinds of organizations, if we were able to get there, the question I would have is what is to prevent those organizations now able to manage costs, able to hold down costs, turning around and demanding significant price increases or prices from health plans for, in other words, not passing through the savings from their cost containment to ultimately to consumers. And so I think the two issues are related.
Yes.
Again, this is part of our...
I'd like to answer that directly.
Go ahead.
I think Bob has raised an essential question, which is what is the counter power, the countervailing power, to use Galbraith's old term, against organizations that would be very large and very powerful. The answer, I think, is being played out, even as we speak, in the state of Massachusetts. The key is that the state of Massachusetts made a bipartisan commitment to cover essentially everybody. Along with that commitment came the requirement of providing subsidies, which impose very significant budget costs. As overall health care spending rose more than was initially assumed in the draft legislation, and a recession came along as well, the state confronted very severe budget pressures and now is talking about very far-reaching, they haven't yet done it, but they're talking about very far-reaching payment reforms. In other words, by making a commitment to universal coverage and the attendant subsidies, a demand is placed on public budgets that pits the revenue and the expenditure side of the budgets against one another in a way they have not been almost anywhere in the U.S. healthcare system. So I think the key to building up the backbone to deal with these organizations is the public commitment to universal or close to universal coverage and the subsidies necessary to make that a reality.
Before you go, Dennis, do you want to stay on that point?
Well, now you gave me something else to talk about.
I didn't let Dennis go.
Go ahead, and then we'll go to Joe.
A couple different things. Again, the public plan and the media and the effect of it, it's going to have. We have no idea what it's going to be. Some people insist that it's going to be lots of people are going to be in the public plan. Some people insist very few people are going to be in the public plan. When you look at the provision in the House bill on the public plan, we don't even know what the public plan is. The public plan conscripts every Medicare provider automatically into its network, and you have to actually opt out to get out of it. We don't know how much it's going to get paid. There's short-term payment instructions in there, but over time, we don't know if that's really going to materialize or not. The secretary, once they have them all in, can cut all of the payments. So we don't really know the impact of what the public plan is going to have on the market. Massachusetts, I apologize for probably too much time at the microphone. I can't resist Massachusetts because I helped negotiate the Massachusetts waiver. The problem with the cost of the Massachusetts waiver wasn't what they created within the exchange. It's all the other additional expenses the politician insists to be in there. They gave $300 million rate increases to the providers. They expanded Medicaid to 300% of poverty. If they actually would have stuck with the market-based reforms, they probably wouldn't be facing the budget problems that they're now having.
Joe?
Well, the idea of digging a deeper hole so that it'll be easier to climb out doesn't make any sense to me. We're already in that deep hole, and Henry, I guess that's true that we, in the sense that Congress is yet to face up to the hole we're already in. So, you know, you're right that we have not confronted this issue, but I really have serious doubts that Congress is going to be any more equipped to face a 20-foot hole than the 10-foot hole we're in now. Medicare, you know, we've been blithely going along without really making any real changes in the Medicare program for a long, long time now. And the news hasn't gotten better year after year. I'm fearful that we will follow the Massachusetts example, which was, as David Cutler said, well, the first thing we've got to do is we've got to get everybody in there, and then we'll think about what we do about costs. We need to think about what we're doing about costs. We need to do that at the same time that we're thinking about how to solve the budget problem. When people say, how are we going to pay for it, all they're really talking about is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic right now. Because as Bob said earlier, a lot of the promising ideas just aren't ready yet. That, to me, is an argument by itself for some reasonable transitional policy rather than trying to bite off the whole thing right at the start.
Go ahead, Judy.
And just when you're talking about holes here, I think that what we are talking about, and the President has made an even stronger commitment that that what he's going to sign is going to be fully funded. That I don't think any of us think that's not a challenge, but that is his commitment. So I think talking about holes here is a bit inappropriate. Challenges I'll take. Mountains maybe, but not holes. I think that in terms of what we're discussing about changing payment mechanisms to promote changes in delivery reform and get the health cost growth slowed, there's an enormous consensus on the directions in which we need to move, albeit recognition of the challenges, as Henry was putting out, in actually moving the system forward. And I think that it is a mistake not to recognize that what the legislation that we're seeing is doing in this regard is moving in that direction, that the Bob, you've talked about essentially getting rid of overpriced services in the physician payment mechanism so that we stop rewarding for so much for low-value, high-tech services and start providing incentives through new kinds of arrangements and shared savings for delivering more coordinated, as Henry was talking about, more efficiently delivered care. Everybody recognizes that that's a huge task, but everybody also thinks that we've got to move in that direction, and the path, I think, is very much there. And finally, I would say, in terms of supporting what Henry's saying, is that we are talking, a lot of the problems that people are mentioning here go well beyond the technical to the political. And when the system, when everyone's got a stake in the system, the commitment to moving forward to actually delivering on better quality care and lower cost growth, everyone becomes responsible for that as an elected official. It changes the political dynamic.
Okay, I have a hunch we'll come back to that. Let me just get a quick question here as you're making your way to the microphone. It's addressed to either Julie or Judy. Let me try Julie first. Was the President really referring to the Senate finance draft on Wednesday night when he said, my bill? Surely he was not referring to either the House bill or the Senate help bill. I won't read the number of exclamation points and question marks after that.
As I think I made clear in my opening statement, I think this was a rhetorical flourish by the President. This is now his plan. Of course, as reporters have tried to flesh this out in subsequent briefings with Robert Gibbs and talks with other administration officials, we haven't seen anything on paper since the speech. So my plan is now what's in the speech, which is more than we had in the budget, but now we have the speech. So take that as you will.
Very good. Yes.
Hi, I'm Rohan Beasle with the NCQA. I detect a bit of disagreement in the panel about whether or not the proposals we've seen really do constitute a expansion in coverage or a fundamental restructuring of the healthcare delivery system. And since there is so much consensus, you know, part of the 80% that Republicans and Democrats seem to agree with is contained within the Baucus white paper that dealt with quality. Isn't this the opportunity where we need to really aggressively start restructuring and realigning incentives to pay for quality instead of sort of leaving that to the next phase?
And let me just relate that to the earlier part of the discussion. Bob, you were talking particularly about how many of the devices for bending the curve are hard to deal with now and are now in demonstration form in one or another of the pieces of legislation, and there are certainly many of them are related directly to quality improvement.
Can I piggyback a question onto that before the panel answers, which is, how ready were the DRGs when we started phasing them in? I mean, I know New Jersey had done it, but I mean, we've done a lot of pretty big changes to the payment system before things were quote unquote ready.
Let me jump in a little bit and distinguish between what's now becoming sort of the mantra, we should stop paying for volume, we should start paying for quality. That, I think, is going to take some time. I don't know that we have a robust set of quality measures to start paying for quality. But we do have a number of specific ideas which have merit around patient-centered medical homes, different versions of accountable care organizations. With one, the House has two models, a shared savings model, and one that would go back towards part, not the full capitation that ran into troubles in the 90s, but a partial capitation model, developing organizations who would be cost conscious and be rewarded for quality. We do have enough quality measures now that I think some of the concerns we had in the 90s about capitation, about stinting of service, we'd be able actually to detect. But the point I'm making here is, with some exceptions, this is not in the health system today, and I think we need to work it through. Judy reminds me that we still have plenty of opportunity to improve the current payment systems that we've got, continued refinement to DRGs, which, in fact, has happened in the last 2 years to get better severity of illness adjustments into DRGs. And I think we have a real opportunity. It's easy to say we should just abandon fee-for-service, but fee-for-service is what is how we're paying doctors in Medicare. And we can improve the RBRVS payment system dramatically by going after mispriced services. I think one of the more successful things that Congress has done in recent years, whether it knew it was doing it at the time, was to reduce the payments for advanced imaging services. And at least in the first year, this was in the DRA legislation at the end of 2005 when they needed to find some money to pay for that year's SGR fix. And what the result was is that in 2007, according to a GAO study, imaging services decreased, the payments for advanced imaging services decreased 13%. The volume of imaging services continued to go up, but not at the same prior rate. The prices came down. It was an instance of good policy, not transforming the healthcare system by any means, but getting the prices better. So I think if we had the will to do it, we could be doing this in a lot of areas. So I don't want to say that. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities that I've seen in this legislation to actually make some significant improvements, and I think it would improve the situation for Medicare beneficiaries rather than threaten them if we actually did some of that while we are doing the more difficult things, which is trying to figure out how to pay for quality, which is what we all want to do, But I think there we need to do more testing.
This is another aspect that's connected to that that's probably the subject of an entire seminar, but you may want to bite off a piece of it and discuss it, and it's related to what Bob was just talking about. Questioner wants to know how health reform will affect how physicians and nurses and other health care providers are compensated for their services. And that would be either in direct changes now or in some of the devices that you're talking about over time. As I say, that this is something that you could probably pick up 100 different aspects of, but maybe what the most important ones are in the immediate and in the long term.
Well, let me jump in initially. Ideally, we would go to the kinds of organizations that Henry was talking about and that they wouldn't just be the same ones we've talked about for 30 years, Geisinger and Intermountain and Group Health of Puget Sound, but that we would – there are actually many more out there that don't have the same, I guess, PR engines that are doing the same – that are – actually organized, doing very good work, and providers, I mean professionals, I don't like to use the term providers for health professionals, would be paid according to how that organization pays them. In many cases it would be on salary with bonuses. In some cases they might pass through the incentives that the insurers provided to the organization, whether that's capitation or fee-for-service. So basically I would think we'd be in a much better situation when the decision-making about how to actually compensate professionals was being made by organizations in which those professionals had a role in governance and some control over their own fate. Where we still have sort of small solos, onesies and twosie docs getting paid directly by the third parties, private insurers and Medicare, it would be nice to move off a fee-for-service, but I don't think that's going to be so easy.
But Bob, even I think you've written about even in the onesies and twosies essentially being able to take advantage of shared savings arrangements that we are talking about promoting into the future.
I think more shared savings, perhaps the patient-centered medical home payment model, which is a hybrid payment model, which is both fee-for-service and a monthly payment to do care coordination and a better job of being primary care docs outside of office visits, I think is a very promising hybrid model. Payment model, and so you could add some pay for performance on top of that. I think that's why I'm encouraged about what's in the House legislation. They would greatly expand the patient-centered medical home demo. Interestingly, in that area, they would add a model in the patient-centered medical home, sort of a community-based component where you'd still have small practices, and in the community, there would be a care coordination disease management capability to work in conjunction with the practices. That's what Vermont has put in. It's the North Carolina Medicaid model. We need to be testing this stuff. One of the things that is getting a lot of attention is to change the way CMS demos have occurred, which is it takes about 8 years from the beginning to when you get an evaluation report, and then who knows what happens next. You need to be able to do real learning and adjustment in real time, and that needs to be in the legislation, and it is in the legislation. CMS needs to be more flexible, and one thing we haven't talked about yet is to do any of this right, CMS needs to be adequately resourced. It is a very thin agency right now, and so there is something of a disconnect between the expectations for all of these new payment models and organizational developments that will occur, and a staffing level that is actually no greater than it was in 1980 at CMS. So CMS would need to be adequately resourced to be able to pull this off.
Good. Dennis?
If I may just add, though, again, on the payment side, and again, there's been lots of things for lots of years on the payment side, on the provider side. I think, though, we also need to be thinking about how you get the beneficiary involved. And in many respects, part of our problem is we keep pushing the beneficiary further and further away from participating in their own decision-making. We keep saying, let's go ahead and make any decision that you want, but you aren't going to have to pay for it. I think provider reform is important, but I think the beneficiary reform is important as well, as for people to understand and participate in the cost of the decisions that they are making as well.
Go ahead, Tony.
I'm interested in knowing what you all think about the co-op proposal that Senator Conrad has and is featured in the Baucus plan. And if you think it's a reasonable idea, are there some provisions that need to be included in it to ensure that they would be successful?
And at the risk of embarrassing myself again, I'll go back to the part that I tried to read before, which suggested that they wanted to know which version of the cooperative model was gaining traction, the state-based co-ops, regional co-ops, or, as they put it, the Schumerized national co-ops. Anybody?
Well, so one of the features of the Baucus outline, which is really pretty puzzling, is his specification about who can't start up or participate in a co-op that he has in mind. And it turns out that if you've ever had anything to do with health insurance, if you know anything about the business, you're not allowed to go in there. So I guess if he really wants them, he better hope they're too big to fail, because they certainly will fail if you don't actually have competent people trying to start these things up and trying to run these programs. You know, this is – the word co-op sounds like a nice soft word, and I'm sure it sounds probably better to people who get their electricity from rural electrical co-ops. So, you know, out west, this is probably a very resonant kind of a term. There's no particular indication that health co-ops actually operate very differently from other kinds of health systems. The illusion of participatory democracy in these things disguises the fact that they're businesses and they operate under the same exact incentives that all the rest of them do. So it's hard for me to see that unless you change the rules, they will have any substantial impact on anything.
Well, what kind of rules might you want to include in them, then?
I'm not real eager to perfect the imperfectible.
I will repeat something that Uwe Reinhardt said a few weeks ago on a panel here, which was that the description to him sounded an awful lot like what we used to call Blue Cross Blue Shield nonprofit mutual plans, and he predicted that within 10 years they would be back arguing that they couldn't compete in the capital markets unless they converted to proprietary status. Forgive me, Senator Conrad, or Senator Schumer.
A quick little ad. If you go to the NPR.org website, Joanne Silberner has done several good stories on several of the co-ops, including Health Partners in the Twin Cities. And I think we did another piece on Group Health of Puget Sound. They've been, you know, operating for years and years, and it's true, they look just like any other nonprofit, regular HMO. I think the question goes back to what we were looking at with Part D, which is, you know, the fundamental idea is to create more competition, and will co-ops create competition where there wouldn't otherwise be competition? I mean, that's the idea of a public plan. It's let's have competition out there. And if you don't want a public plan, you know, I remember going through all of this, you know, Sturm und Drang in 1997 about these PSOs, the provider-sponsored organizations, and we had the negotiated rulemaking. And, it, you know, it went on and on and on. We were going to have doctors and hospitals, you know, banding together to create these, you know, the again, the idea was to create competition. And I think in the end we got, if I remember correctly, two. Right, two.
It was a wild success.
Yeah, it was a huge success. So, you know, you can go through all of this trouble to create this enormous, you know, mechanism in Washington, but in the end, if the market out there doesn't want there to be these entities, they're not going to happen.
If I could just correct the record, I believe there were three. But I would also mention, as we talk about accountable care organizations and think of the model that is somewhat risk-bearing, issues around PSOs that came up are going to be back. This stuff ain't easy. I think it's exactly the right stuff to be working on, but these new organizations that we want to promote, I think there's been some facile thinking about the challenges here, and we need to work through them. But we may be back talking about PSOs again.
And by the way, let me just ask, as we move into the second half of this program, as we go forward, I'd appreciate it if you'd help us to improve these programs by filling out the blue evaluation forms you have in your materials. And with that, the lady in the back of the room.
Yes, hi. Hannah Meeprash from MedPAC. And this is a question on the media coverage of the current debate. I've been both a little bit horrified by the attention paid to death panels, but also pretty impressed with efforts to explain complicated concepts like the RUC process or today's New York Times article on immunosuppressive coverage after you get a kidney transplant in Medicare. And so I'm wondering, for you, what has surprised you about the coverage of this debate, and how do you think that will affect the coverage of the next healthcare debate?
I'd like to hear from the rest of the panel.
Yeah, Julie.
No, I'd like to hear from the rest of the panel.
She thinks the coverage has been terrific. but
only in certain outlets.
What's that website again? Judy?
It's hard to be surprised by coverage. So, and I think that you have rightly identified that there's been a range. I think coverage of this kind of issue, it's true today as it was true in the past, is not always as educational as we would like it to be. And I'm too old to be disappointed in that, but I think it is a truth that there's not as much educating goes on as we would wish. The media's picking up what hot stuff. And so I think that's problematic. My sense, and I, you know what side of this issue I'm on, is getting it done. So it is my sense that that in the post-August, and we've only had 2 weeks into September, but that I have been more impressed with the discussion in the media since August than I was for much of August. So
that's a worse.
Well, there's that. It couldn't get, as Julie said, it couldn't get much worse. But I think that we are seeing a fair amount of pretty objective, informative discussion, and it's I'm obviously talking about only the part of the media that I listen to, which is I still read the paper and watch public television and listen to NPR. So I'm not speaking for the non-mainstream media, which I think does its thing. That's what it's there for.
I'll make a quick comment
ahead,
that on this point, it's you were asking how we would expect a change in the future, and one might look back at the Clinton reform and realize Judy's point about reading the newspaper. Probably everybody in this room reads the newspaper. Everybody in the country read the newspaper in 1994. Today, outside of this room, nobody reads the newspaper. They all get their information from television, which is inevitably distorting in the sense that you can't possibly explain anything even simple in the 10 seconds that I think typically happens. So my prediction for the future is that we will have the thoughts immediately
beamed into our heads, eliminating all the cognitive functions that we may still be exercising today.
In the year 2525, I believe was the name of that song. Yes, go ahead.
I'm Todd Lewenberg with Thompson Publishing Group. Noticing the discussion that there still remains uncertainty about the exchanges, which obviously don't exist, but we even had some discussion that we weren't certain that people would show up and sign up, and significantly also I think that as far as funding through savings and eliminating inefficiencies, that you also have somewhat of a uncertainty in terms of are the savings going to materialize when you rationalize a system and so forth. And with that as a backdrop, there's been a lot of statements from the administration and so forth that they do not want to harm what works and what is working in the healthcare finance system. And most of working people get their coverage through their employer. So my question is about the employer-based system. And piece of paper out here. There's been a lot of speculation that this plan would result in an erosion of the employer base, a removal of the stability under which the employer-based market has worked, and that you'd have a incentives for people to leave employer-based plans that would erode the either in one. In the case of insured plans that would raise their premiums and lead them to send their workers to the public option, and on the other hand, you'd have an exodus from self-insured plans, which would also lead to more risk and, again, possible, erosion of those plans. And so that I think that would qualify as harming what works right now. And if I can get to the question, how do you answer the fear that it would erode both insured and self-insured plans? And what do you think
I think we got.
Yeah, you got the point. What do you think those plans would look like in 10 years or 5 years? Whether or not there's the erosion that I described.
And can I just add an element to that question, which is based on the latest current population survey reports, we're already seeing a continuing erosion in the coverage being offered by private employers. So in the context of erosion, how much erosion are we talking about?
Do you want to go first?
Henry?
We are talking about 16% or 17% of the U.S. economy, $2.5 trillion, tens of millions of employees delivering services, insurance, products, and so on. It's pretty clear there are some gross flaws with the current system. Stepping in to correct those flaws with 100% certainty will produce unanticipated consequences. The idea that legislation in this area is going to be free of side effects, some of which we didn't want, necessitating further legislation in future years, the idea that that's not going to happen is beyond naive innocence. There are certain gross flaws. We are having a national debate on how best to deal with those. The effects are going to be some of them predictable and some of them unpredictable, and we're going to be back to fix the mistakes in future years. The idea that we shouldn't move ahead because we can't fully anticipate what the consequences will be, I think, is a big mistake. What specifically is going to happen to employment-based coverage will depend on the details of the legislation, which, as Julie's brilliant summary at the outset made very clear, is, to put it mildly, still in play. And consequently, I think I, for one, would not hazard an answer to specifically which direction, up or down, employment-based coverage is going to go. I'm going to mention one thing that exchanges will do if they're done right. would have the potential of doing over time that would greatly strengthen the employment-based system, which is to say you'd end job lock, the idea that when you change jobs you necessarily lose coverage. If an increasing number of employers provide subsidies for individuals to buy their employees to buy insurance through the exchange, the individual worker has the relationship to the plan, the employer subsidizes the worker, there's no need to change plans when you change jobs. That's one of the major wraps on the current system, and if you could correct that, it would be almost worth the price of admission by itself.
Judy?
Yeah.
And then Julie.
Well, there are a tremendous number of uncertainties. Henry's absolutely correct. I think that there we also have a little bit of evidence of in Massachusetts of experience with of the kind that we are talking about in health reform, and with the requirements on individuals to purchase coverage and the requirements on employers to provide coverage, the employer-sponsored coverage has gone up. And it seems to me that the efforts being made, because people, whatever one may argue about the merits of broader portability or greater choice, people are very concerned about being able to make those choices themselves and not have them made for them. So I think that what we've seen in the legislative process is a considerable effort to preserve the employer-sponsored health insurance, and that's what I would expect will emerge in the legislation.
Julie?
You know, if I could go back for a second to the previous question about how the media has handled this, one of the things I think the media has done fairly well this time are some of these fact check of some of the big myths that have been told. But I think one of the myths that hasn't really been looked at is one of the things that the President's been saying, that, you know, if you like what you have, you can keep it. And I think one of the things that's really been missed in a lot of this, and I think the census numbers that came out last week really showed this, the reason that the number of uninsured didn't go up as a net last week is that a number of people, it was about 1.5 million, lost private insurance. This is a long-standing trend. It's been going down since the 70s. But that many more people, it was actually more than that because it picked up the population increase, got public insurance. So this idea that if nothing, if the country doesn't do anything, that you could, if you like what you have, you can keep it, is a myth. We are already the frog in the pot of water, and the heat is going up. So this idea that, you know, if Congress doesn't do anything, I mean, the President is actually telling the truth when he says that if nothing happens at all, the idea that you can keep what you have is a myth. So the chances, and it's true, everyone says, oh, well, he may be, you know, he's probably lying when he says, as Henry says, when you do this, if you pass some big bill, the chances that you might not be able to keep what you have if you like it, that's entirely possible. There may be all kinds of new incentives for your employer to stop offering insurance. You may end up somewhere else. You may end up with a plan you don't like. But you're just as likely to end up without insurance or with a plan you don't like if nothing happens. And I think that's the part that the public is really missing, that employer-provided insurance is going down, and it's going down rapidly because costs are going up. It's just that it's going down, I shouldn't say really rapidly, it's going down gradually because costs are going up inexorably. It's just going down 1 million at a time when there's 160 million people who have employer-provided insurance. So people aren't feeling it because, like that, you know, the proverbial frog in the pot of water, it's just getting hotter a little bit at a time.
Which is amazing. Dennis, how's the temperature over there?
Yeah, I think when you look at the experience of after SCHIP was created, State Children's Health Insurance Program was created, and what happened to the coverage of children, I think the displacement or the shift between public and private, I think, is apparent. So if it happened for kids, it makes sense it'll happen for other populations as well. ARC came out with a study near the end of August that basically said before SCHIP was created, there was 5.9 million uninsured kids. 10 years later, there were still 5.9 million uninsured kids. But the shift, when you look at the percentage served by private sector and the percentage served by the public sector, those lines cross over a period of time. So I think it's realistic to expect the same thing to happen. I think the question is, if it's going to happen, do we care enough to try to prevent it? And if we do, then are there other policies that should be adopted going along with the existing policies? So again, part of the question in my mind is, It's likely going to happen. Do we care? Do we care enough to then also adopt other policies to try to prevent it?
Dennis, I think actually that there has been a fair amount of caring in the drafting of legislation, so that the design of certainly what's in the House bill is really quite different from the design of SCHIP and the way you're talking about, and employer-sponsored coverage goes up.
And correct me if I'm wrong, are there not some provisions in these bills that would buck up particularly small business?
I think the reality, though, in Judy's statement, people are then going to start being confronted with the reality, are we actually then increasing costs for low-income populations? Are we actually going to make them take something that today they think is unaffordable to them? And is that the right policy then to adopt?
I don't think that was what I was raising, because there are affordability exceptions, as I read the House bill, that enables people to go from employer-sponsored coverage into exchanges. But for the most part, the exchanges are for people who do not have employer-sponsored insurance and for very small business.
But in terms of the policies that do affect people who have currently access to employer-sponsored insurance, are you basically saying you have to take it? There are some exceptions for people who are on Medicaid. There are some exceptions. And then there's some hardship waivers, whatever that's going to be. But I think the reality is people are going to start, when they think through these entire policies, people who have made decisions now that they can't afford it through their employer, you're going to make them basically start spending, making an expenditure for what they have determined they cannot afford.
That's a thing. When the implications of the individual mandate are will be noticed, I think. And I think that in terms of the affordability, it's important to note that the level of benefits that are being required in this plan are far from even, I don't know what car we compare benefits to these days, but they are quite reasonable levels of benefits. Some would say less than reasonable levels of benefits. There are affordability protections, and I think those are important to remember. The question was about whether they're going to be in employer-sponsored coverage, and I believe they will.
Just a factual point, I believe, in the Baucus principles, the individual mandate doesn't apply to the Medicaid eligible.
Right, and let me just follow up with another question based on exceptions. And also let me just observe that we have more green cards than you can hang on a Christmas tree, and not all that much time to cover them. So if you absolutely, positively have to have your question asked, you better repair to a microphone. This one, however, makes the cut and sketches a scenario for us. Congress passes an employer mandate with businesses with 50 or more employees. Let's say several dozen of these companies employ an Amish person who's opposed to insurance, or a member of a health care sharing ministry who share their expenses without insurance. The Amish and the member pay their medical bills. Should the employer be penalized if these people don't desire insurance? And if an individual mandate is passed, should these people be exempt? And I would call people's attention to the situation in Massachusetts, which I think presented some of these same questions.
Do you know what they did in Massachusetts? Yeah,
actually, they do. Actually, yeah. They did have a religious exemption in Massachusetts.
This is why you have a regulatory process.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is why you have a regulatory process, I mean, to determine questions like this. I mean, I'm sure there will be exceptions for cases of conscientious objection or special cases.
And I'm told that there are a fair number of people who have suddenly discovered a religious aversion to insurance in Massachusetts.
I would think you would have to have some sort of verification there. There seems to be a lot of interest in verification these days.
Joe?
It goes well beyond that. If you look at the one of the versions of the House bill, you see that at every turn there is a new body, a new person yet to be named, who will decide on very fundamental questions the benefit package and a whole host of other issues that you'd really like to know the answer to, and you won't get that answer. So
well, otherwise the bill would be, you know, 5,000 pages long.
That's not the reason. Length is never a problem if you don't have to read the bill. There are two problems. One is that a lot of these questions cannot really be answered in the course of a couple of months by a bunch of politicians and their staffs. Worse yet, it probably can't be answered by a bunch of experts in years of study. But if you're going to lay out outlines, you're going to have to leave holes. So this is, this is one of the easier holes, because you can imagine an exceptions process. But what about the things that you actually have to decide on before you put the plan in place?
By the way, this reminds me of the one statement that I think everybody on the panel would agree that President Obama misstated in his speech on Wednesday night, which was that he intended to be the last president to work on this problem. I've got a question that's addressed, at least initially, to Joe and Dennis. Your organizations had supported the idea of limiting the deductibility of health insurance for tax purposes. Now, for political reasons, that isn't going anywhere, but Chairman Baucus has a 35% tax on insurance companies who offer policies valued at over $8,000 for individuals and $21,000 for families. Do you think this achieves the same result, and are you supportive of that? And what do you think happens in the market if it's passed? I'll take that for a no.
Could I actually add something to that?
Sure.
The estimates are that the revenue raised directly from that tax will be zero. It increases overall tax revenues substantially because, to the extent that the tax is effective in discouraging such policies, workers will receive a larger proportion of their compensation in the form of taxable wages rather than untaxed health insurance. So that's where the revenue gain comes from. Secondly, this is a point that Peter Orszag stresses because he understands compound interest very well, everything in that proposal depends on the indexing provision. The indexing provision in the Senate version is to the Consumer Price Index. Given the more rapid growth of health care spending, that limit becomes increasingly severe, and possibly over time too severe, in limiting the amount of health insurance that people would in fact receive. Built within that, implicitly over the long haul, are big increases in cost sharing. It's the corollary of insurance that is bites decreasingly into the total health care bill. So that provision is, in my view, a bit of a meat axe, but it shouldn't be criticized for being too small or timid.
So let me add to that. I agree with what Henry just said. This particular idea is a kind of a gimmick because it allows politicians to say, we're not taxing you, we're taxing some company that you don't actually like anyway. But, of course, as Henry indicated, the real economic effect does affect you directly. And in the sense that it is more dishonest policymaking, that's not a good thing, because people actually ought to come to understand what they're doing with respect to their compensation and what deal is it that they're actually making with their employer about how they get paid. I'm concerned that this particular dodge might actually not lead to the adjustment in wages that all economists think ultimately making these kinds of benefits more taxable. That it might slow down the transition to higher wage income and lower contributions for health insurance. The initial reaction, I think, from many employers who I think themselves don't necessarily understand their own compensation arrangements, and responding to pressure from employees might in fact be to say, well, gee, we've got to do something here, but it's really hard to talk to the insurance agent, so instead of doing that, we'll kick in a little bit more, we'll slow down the wage increases even more than they have been, and we'll ask the employees to also pay a little bit more in dollar terms for their insurance. So that would actually delay the transition that I think everybody who supports limiting the tax exclusion really would like to see. In the end, what both of these policies, the indirect deceitful policy and the direct policy that may not ever be passed, drive at is that people ought to have more of a say in how they spend their money. Because, in fact, although it is true that the employer contribution is part of their compensation, it's also being spent for them. And not everybody wants to spend the money that way.
I've got a question addressed to you, Julie. What is your assessment of the so-called markup 2 in energy and commerce? Now, and I would be interested in knowing whether markup 2 is markup after the Blue Dog conversation or markup after the progressive conversation after the Blue Dog conversation?
Well, this is actually really none of the above. At the very end, for those of you who were really paying attention to the energy and commerce markup, I think it was Friday night, actually the way the markup was concluded was that there was an opportunity to come back and reopen the bill. And this is an ability, actually, if the leadership would like to make some changes via the Energy and Commerce Committee, this is a way that they can do it. So it is a possibility that Energy and Commerce could reopen the bill and come back and do it. I am not counting on that as a likely venue. But it is still a live possibility that that bill could be reopened, even though it's technically been reported by the Energy and Commerce Committee. I haven't spoken with staff since they did that. Remember, this was the night before they left for recess. So I am not speaking from knowledge here. I am speaking from speculation spent from watching an awful lot of committee markups. I'm not thinking that they're anxious to reopen it, but it is the way they left it. It is a live possibility.
Okay. Yes,
David Connolly from Capital Associates, and I have a question for Julie. It's kind of an end of the session question. It hasn't really been touched upon, and it's an ERISA question, and it really is a pension question. And it's this, in referencing the fact that we all read the newspaper in this room, but probably most of America don't. And if we all read the newspaper in this room, we're probably all covered by pension plans. So my question is, why hasn't the media focused on who really owns the insurance companies in this country? Who really are the health insurance companies? It's not, it's not AHIP, and it's not the face of AHIP, with all due respect to Karen. It's the shareholders of the insurance companies who are whom, Julie, in this country, and why hasn't that story been told?
That's a very good point. It's the big pension funds. Yes, I see where you're going with this. That's a very good story, and I think I will. But I think there have been a lot of stories though about there's a big bifurcation in the health insurance industry between the for-profits and the non-profits, and I think that's actually been lost. I think in the president's eagerness to kind of recast this debate as health insurance reform instead of health reform, and kind of beat up on the health insurance industry's indiscretions, if you will, and talk about rescissions and talk about all the insecurity of the health insurance haves. It's been a little bit lost in the mix, but I think there's been a fair bit of investigative reporting, certainly about campaign contributions and who's getting what, and the idea that this gang of six represents the population of like 2% of the country making all these big decisions. But I think that is a line that hasn't really been looked at. On the other hand, I don't think that the health insurance industry is having the kind of influence on the debate this time that they had the last time. That may be one reason why that hasn't been as interesting a line of pursuit as others. It's been a different kind of debate this time. It's been a debate where I think the loudest voices are getting heard. Maybe that's the 24-hour cable news cycle. It's been, I have to say, you know, I covered the debate the last time around. In some ways, this has been a harder debate to follow because there's been less there. We've had this kind of, you know, we've got plans here and there. It's hard to explain in three sentences what it is. We've got some coverage, we've got some costs, but it's pretty amorphous. So, you know, no wonder the public is confused. And I was, I must say, quoted out of context in a story saying, well, if she's confused, why didn't she stop covering this? I feel bad.
That's great. That's the first pre-publication disclaimer I've ever heard.
I would like to say now, I am not confused, but it is difficult to explain this, I admit, this time around. It is more difficult to explain it this time around than it was last time around, and I think last time around we didn't do a great job either.
But that's so, because you've had so much practice.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Judy. Notwithstanding, there's lots of good stories out there, and actually maybe to wrap up, I think we're going to have plenty of time to do lots more good stories, because I don't think this is ending anytime real soon.
Okay. We actually are near the end of our time, and what I'd like to do is give each of our panelists 1 minute to answer the question that they really wanted to answer and didn't get a chance because it wasn't asked. How about that for an opportunity? You must have come prepared with the notes that said, I'm glad you asked that question. Now here's what I want to say. What do you think? Dennis, you want to? But I have a question actually directed to Bob Berenson that I would rather, that I can always fill in with, and it's really tough.
Go for it.
Okay. This is actually from a member of the congressional staff. So they're looking for help, Bob. Please describe what the healthcare market will look like in terms of the cost of premiums, the uninsured rate, the share of GDP. In 5, 10, 15 years, if the elements of reform being proposed are either incremental or not.
No way.
In 1 minute.
I'm not doing that.
Ed?
Go ahead.
Henry can do it.
Bernard Baruch, who was an early 20th century financier, was once asked, since he knew everything, what the stock market was going to do. And I think his answer is the right answer for Ed's question. He said, it will fluctuate.
And as it turns out, people who quote Bernard Baruch are the 10th wonder of the world. And I think that's unless somebody wants to interject in that, we're going to end on that note. Let me remind you to fill out your blue evaluation forms, if you would. I want to thank the folks at Lilly for their participation and support. I want to thank you for your wealth of questions and apologize to those of you who asked them and we couldn't get to them. And ask you to join me in thanking our Ask the Experts panel. You were terrific.
That was great. It was good to feel.